good morning to you. I'm Libby Price. Welcome to a Country Breakfast on RN. Grain harvest is well underway in the wheat belts across Australia, and it's something of a tradition to celebrate a bountiful harvest. So what do they do in the far northwest of New South Wales when there is no harvest due to yet another drought? Why, of course, have a no-harvest party.
Is really just that people can step away from whatever it is and just forget, and, you know, just to catch up with friends, because it's, you know, it's really important to, you know, keep those social interactions no matter how old you are.
And if you can't get a bit of rain, you may as well have a party.
Yeah, but if you don't laugh, you'll cry. That story coming up a little later on A Country Breakfast. We'll also travel the country with our rural reporters. But before that, let's find out what's been making news this week with Kath McAlone. And Kath, the big announcement this week, I'm sure, even shocked Joe Hockey as he made it. Certainly wouldn't have been what he would have liked to have announced.
Yeah, some big news on Friday with Joe Hockey making an announcement that the government will reject Archer Daniels Midland's bid for GrainCorp. Grain growers have been left gobsmacked by the announcement. Most farmers thought that the Treasurer would approve the sale, but that he would impose conditions on it. Mr. Hockey rejected that option, though. He said there's no conditions that could mitigate his concerns, and imposing conditions would leave GrainCorp hamstrung in its ability to adapt to a changing market. ADM had been offering a $200 million commitment for rail infrastructure investment. That is, of course, now off the table, which some farmers had sort of thought that was a pretty nice sweetener that had been put out. New South Wales Farmers Association Grains Chairman Dan Cooper says it's a shame, but he says the result is a far better one for farmers.
In the short term, obviously, GrainCorp's going to feel some pain, but our concerns have always been that we weren't going to be better off. No one could assure us that we were going to be better off. You know, there was a lot of fluff around what was being discussed, big picture thinking and a nice glossy brochure about what ADM could bring to the table, but no one could be specific about how growers could benefit. If that's the way they intended to run it, then I'm confident that we're in a better position than we would have been if the sale had gone ahead without any conditions.
Oh, I guess it's not really terribly surprising that Archer Daniels Midland is disappointed.
No, not a surprise at all. GrainCorp is also disappointed. Archer Daniels Midland says that their offer for GrainCorp would have created value for shareholders of both companies. Meanwhile, GrainCorp chairman Don Taylor says that his company will now need to go back to the drawing board to work out what to do next.
It's not the end of the world, but it's obviously not the outcome we expected. I feel like I've lost a year of my life, to be honest. I mean, this deal's been going on for 13 months and, you know, the company's really been in sort of a hiatus situation of standstill for 13 months. All the effort that we've put in has obviously come to naught.
Let's move on now to this spying row with Indonesia and the likely impact it's going to have on trade.
There's been lots of sort of speculation about whether it will indeed impact trade between Australia and Indonesia. Indonesia's a big buyer of our beef, one commodity, for example. But Indonesian beef importers are saying that they don't believe that there'll be any impact on trade from the spying row with Australia. Indonesia's trade minister says that he's asked the parliament to consider looking for other countries to supply beef. But Australia's trade minister, Andrew Robb, believes that any concerns that Indonesia might have can be overcome. So far this year, Indonesia has imported 47,000 tonnes of boxed beef, and almost half of that came from Australia, so a big buyer of our beef. Permits for the next year are expected to be issued in about 3 weeks, so we'll know for sure then whether there has been any impact. Thomas Sembering is the president of Indonesia's Beef Importers Association. He doesn't think that Indonesian vets will allow imports of beef from Brazil and India, possible competition to Australia, because there's a risk of foot and mouth disease from those countries.
According to my opinion, they will get a protest from the veterinary association. If there is a case of foot and mouth disease, they are the one who takes the burden because they are veterinarians, so they don't want to take any risk.
In the meantime, though, live cattle are still heading to Indonesia.
There's showing no signs of the trade slowing down. Nick Thorne was among those that were helping to load thousands of live cattle bound for Indonesia onto the ship, the Barclay Pearl, at the port of Darwin during the week. He says the trade is showing no signs of slowing.
Let's just hope it's speak and doesn't become reality. It's not nowhere near as viable for Indonesia to source cattle from India or South America. I mean, Australia is a logical place. I think it's just these things are said in times like this. I don't think it's ever going to come to anything.
Whether you call it the Holy Cheese Wars or the Great Butter Battle, it is extraordinary to think there's so much interest in one little dairy processor in Victoria.
That's right. The price that's being offered for shares in Warrnambool Cheese and Butter just keeps going up and up. And this week, Murray Goulburn Dairy Cooperative increased its bid. It's now offering $9.50 cash per share. That trumps a rival offer by Canadian dairy company Saputo of about $9.20, and it also betters a combined cash and share deal being offered by Bega Cheese. And the price could even go higher, with Murray Goulburn not yet declaring that as their final offer. Murray Goulburn's managing director, Gary Halu, says if the cooperative's bid is successful, it'll benefit the entire Australian dairy industry.
We have gone through this rigorously and prudently. We still believe that this will add value from day one to farm gate milk price. Otherwise, we won't proceed with it.
Now, we will be hearing a little more on this later on A Country Breakfast, but it's not great news with SPC Admona 6 months after it announced substantial cuts to contracts.
That's right. Growers that do still have contracts with SPC Admona have been told that the company won't be paying any more for their fruit, so effectively a price freeze on fruit, while they continue to sort of sort out how they can go about saving the company. Back in April, of course, the fruit processor met with growers, and that was the meeting at which many contracts were cancelled and some growers were sacked, I guess. It led to bulldozing of trees and some growers going bankrupt. The managing director of SPC Admona, Peter Kelly, says the factory needs government assistance if it's going to survive.
We need that investment. You know, things like currency and unfair trade and dumping, they are matters for the government to solve, those matters. They run the economy. They run the rules of the economy. They run the WTO rules. And I think we have a strong case to show that maybe they should have done a bit more.
Interesting to watch that one. I can't imagine the state government giving any money, so I guess it's going to be up to the federal government. In the meantime, what have fruit growers said?
Well, fruit growers have accepted that price freeze. I guess they don't have much other option but to accept it. Grower and Deputy Chair of Fruit Growers Victoria, Gary Godwill, says it's up to government to save their industry.
Without that innovation being ramped up, without the capital being invested in the innovative products that SPC Admona wants to go along with, then I think we're all finished. We're all dead in the water.
Now, to that other Jackman, not Hugh but Malcolm, he was the head of Elders, and the very day he announced he was resigning, he stopped work.
That's right. During the week, Malcolm Jackman, who was, as you said, the head of Australia's largest agribusiness company, Elders, announced his resignation and left immediately. He says that he wasn't pushed to quit. Interestingly, his announcement comes at a time when Elders has recently posted a $500 million loss. Mr. Jackman says that he had the support of the Elders board and its chairman, but he denies that he's leaving earlier than planned and that's a sign of tension.
No, well, not in this case, okay, and so maybe I'm the exception that proves the rule. Mark and I met yesterday afternoon and the day before in Sydney, and we flew down on the plane this morning deliberately sitting next to each other and discussing all the things we needed to discuss. So you can ask him the same question. There's absolutely no tension at all.
And that Mark there is Mark Allison, the chairman of Elders. I don't know that I would have been sitting in the middle anyway.
It would have been an interesting conversation.
And at last, Queensland has had some rain.
That's right. We've heard so much about the drought conditions in Queensland and parts of the north, and it seems that the wet season has well and truly arrived in North Queensland. Last weekend, 270 millimetres was dumped in Bowen in just over an hour, and rainfall figures are finally starting to build up in parts of the Gulf and central Queensland, and that's thanks to a monsoonal low. There's even been some minor flooding on the Dawson River. But livestock agent Rod Turner from the drought-declared Maranoa Shire in southern Queensland says that rain from the storm is a bit of a lottery.
I've been driving around on the weekend, and where they've had the rain, they've probably got 4 to 6 inches of green shoot now, and it's just starting to look very good, and people are starting to get a bit of hope back and a bit of heart back in the job where they've had the rain, but there's still a lot of very, very dry places around and places that have missed out completely.
Thank you, Kath.
Thanks, Libby.
Kath McAloon with this week's Rural News. Rural Reporter is next.
Hello there, Geraldine Doogue here. Some big decisions are shortly facing the Treasurer, acting as proxy for us taxpayers, regarding the ownership of our agriculture. It's really all about getting capital into this sector, where we've felt such expertise for so long, but we just don't seem to be able to source big money from within. Why not? Is there a bigger role for government? And a dramatic tale of collateral damage in US foreign policy just starting to emerge 30 years on. Don't miss Saturday Extra after 7:30 here on RN.
This week we're off to school, a tiny one-teacher school in North Queensland with just 10 students. We see how failed racehorses can be retrained for the show ring. Horses are also helping out some troubled Aboriginal kids in the Northern Territory, and Afghan refugees finding a career in the shearing shed.
It's opened my eyes a lot, probably a little bit apprehensive for a start, but once I met them and saw what they could do and their friendly nature, it's been a good experience.
We'll hear more from shearing contractor Ian McConnell a little later, but first, some of the challenges of delivering education in the bush.
It's lunchtime in the schoolyard and a fierce game of handball is underway. This is Prairie Primary, a tiny school about 2 hours west of Townsville in North Queensland, with just 10 students.
Toby Rankin, year 7. It's small, and yeah, it's fun. You can do more things, small amount of kids, and yeah.
What sort of things do you do? What do you like doing?
Playing sport and getting amongst it.
You've been here since grade 1. Have you seen things change over that time?
Yeah, the library, the tennis court, PNC shed, and the sandpit.
What about the kids?
Oh, yeah. 17 last year and they went down. So you get good friends and they leave. Yeah, it's a bit sad.
Hello, I'm Miriam Hall. You might be forgiven for thinking there'd be lots of disadvantages in attending a remote one-teacher school. But these kids seem to enjoy studying in a place where everyone knows their name.
I'm Matthew Mustin and I'm in year 7. I'm a school captain. It's a small school, so you really get to be friends with really everyone because there's not many people to be friends with.
So you just have to be friends with them?
Yep.
Sometimes in schools, I guess there are little friendship groups form, maybe little cliques, people have their disagreements. Have you seen that happening a bit in your class?
Yeah, sometimes it happens, but in the end it all ends up working out and everyone's all friends.
I know, everybody gets along.
At a bigger school, there are a lot more people to be friends with, but sometimes you don't get along with everyone.
Computers make your life easier.
Yes. Sometimes.
Lunch is over and it's back to the classroom where all the kids from grade 1 to 7 study in the same room.
And it's neater.
It's neater than handwriting. Okay.
But it's
Tammy McClymont, I'm the principal at Prairie State School. It's a very small school. There's probably about 300, 350 small schools in Queensland. This is one of the smaller ones. We've got 10 students and one teacher. It's not easy. It's not for everyone. The kids tend to work in ability groups more than year levels. You ask some of these kids what grade they're in, they're going to have trouble telling you. But they do the work appropriate for their grade level.
It's almost like a Montessori approach.
It is. And how we teach depends on the individual child. So because there's so few kids, and even though it's just myself and quite often a teacher aide or it might be the administration officer in the library, we've got the flexibility to be able to teach the kids the way they best learn, whether it's hands-on or on paper.
You're part of, I guess, a long tradition of Australian teachers. You know, we talk a lot about one-teacher schools in our history, governesses, a lot of bush schools were run by one-teachers. Do you ever look to history or look to people that have gone before you for inspiration of what you're doing?
I actually kind of do. I was homeschooled.
Oh, really?
Right through primary school, my mum taught us. For me, it's not something different. It's something that's always been there. It's just a necessity for out in the bush. It's homeschooling doesn't suit everybody, and it suits some kids a lot better. We've had kids come from bigger schools simply because for them, this environment suits them and they're learning much better than some of the big schools.
My name's Sharon Johnson. I live in Prairie. We have a property south of Torrens Creek and we run a small business in Huandon.
And you've got how many kids at this school?
Three kids.
So you're 30% of the school?
Yep, 30%.
How old are your children?
7, 9 and 11. They tend to all learn things as a whole, so whatever they're doing in the curriculum, they're all doing it to their different levels. They're coming along. I've got a child that has some little little learning issues, and it's being picked up and guided, and it's probably, he may be slipping through the cracks if he'd been in a bigger school, but it's, you know, because he's little there one-on-one, it's really, they've noticed those things and bringing on and moving forward.
Putting our parcels on the trolley and pushing the trolley to...
Hi, I'm Kate and I'm 10.
Who are your friends in the class?
All the boys, because I'm the only girl in grade 5, 6, 7.
You're the only girl, so you've got lots of male friends.
Yeah.
How's that? Do you ever sort of wish you had some other girls to hang around with?
Yes.
But so how have you managed to make friends with the boys?
Well, play handball with them and talk to them.
Just your standard stuff?
Yep.
What's the best thing about going here?
All the kids are happy and teachers.
The teachers are happy too?
Yeah.
Is it ever hard to be in a class with kids who are younger than you, like the preppies and the grade ones?
No.
How come?
Because they're always funny and run around a lot.
What's it like on your place? I know you're from a property. Can you tell me a little bit about the property?
Well, it's very dry and... all the dams are nearly empty.
Is that worrying for your family?
Yes, we have to sell all the cows because if we don't, we won't get enough money to buy all the polypipe to put water in.
Do you like living on a property?
Sometimes. It's sometimes a bit hot to live out there.
What's fun about it?
You can go out riding motorbikes and learn how to drive cars.
What's it like coming to school and being with your brother and sister all the time?
Pretty good. Sometimes they get a little bit annoying though. Well, they yell and make a lot of noise when you're trying to get to sleep.
But it sounds like, on the whole, you like going to school with them.
Yes. They don't really annoy me when I'm doing work and they don't jump on top of me and pull my hair.
That's very considerate of them, isn't it?
Yeah.
And sometimes we do that.
How does this town, I guess, support this school? You said that everyone's very proud and supportive of Prairie State School. Just 10 little kids in this school. How does the community get behind you?
It can be really simple things from the whole community turns up for speech night. We've got 6 families and you'll probably end up with between 50 and 100 people here for speech night at the end of the year, which tops a lot of schools. Everybody just pitches in where they can, and it doesn't have to be monetary, it doesn't have to be work, it can just be showing up.
Why do you think it's so important?
It's a focal point of the community. We don't have much here. We've got a police station, we've got a pub and we've got the school. And for local people here, education's so important because it gives the kids options. If the children want to stay here and want to remain in the community or on the family properties, then that's fantastic. But if they don't, by having a good school, the students have a really good option for their future.
Do you ever worry about the future of this school?
You do. Numbers fluctuate, but we're lucky. There's a few young kids moving into the district or that are coming on that will be coming to school. It's always a concern what's happening to these schools, because once the schools in the community is closed down, then that's one vital part of the community that's gone. But for now, we're pretty confident Prairie will keep going for quite a few years to come.
It just takes probably 6 months to reprogram the brain to make them from a racehorse, we're not galloping anymore, to this is a cruisy life, just cruising around.
Right, we've got a good line-up of off-the-track horses in Ring 3, so if anyone hasn't seen this pass before, it's getting very popular at all shows in the country. that in Melbourne.
For every winner on the racetrack, there are literally hundreds of thoroughbred horses which have been tried and failed to make the grade. Unfortunately, most of them end up as pet food, but a new program set up by the racing industry is encouraging people to give ex-racehorses another chance at life. G'day, I'm Warwick Long at the Myrtleford Show in northeast Victoria, where nine horses are competing today in the off-the-track event category. The program is being sponsored by Racing Victoria to showcase how these former gallopers can go on to have a second life at horse shows. Lee Dunstan is judging today's competition.
Well, traditionally, ex-race horses have been used not only in showing, but in eventing and show jumping and all manner of disciplines in equestrian sport. But now Racing Victoria is attempting to formalise it a little bit more by making this event available to all country shows, and the event is specifically for horses that have raced, thoroughbreds that have raced or at least had barrier trials. So they've started in the thoroughbred industry, they've ended up as show hacks.
So it's a real recognition of their graduation, really, from one industry to another.
Well, the fact that they have a life after racing and, you know, often a very productive, happy life as a show horse.
So what are you looking for? Obviously, racehorse trainers are looking for different things in these horses now to what they've graduated to. What are you looking for in this show ring?
Well, you know, the qualities of a good thoroughbred and the qualities of a good show hack are very similar. You want a horse that's correct conformationally. You want him to be able to move well. You want him attractive. I know that doesn't make them run any faster, but it's surprising how often the really good racehorses are also good lookers, you know. It just seems to happen that way. So, and you want to see a horse in good coat, in good health, and with reasonable manners.
Do you like this idea as a concept?
I think this is a brilliant idea. So these, you know, there's about 100 ag shows throughout Victoria, and so they're all getting onto this idea and using these as qualifier events, and then the winners will go on to the state championship at the Victorian Ag Society's Saddle Horse Championships at Bendigo in January.
Registrations will be checked. Place names will be used where appropriately when entering if name is different to right.
There's no raucous applause in the Myrtleford show ring, but the winner has been named, and it's Eliza Green from Wangaratta, who together with her mum Libby are here showing today, and they're very proud of their horse.
His show name's Rock Republic. He's a thoroughbred, but his racing name was On a Quest. He had about 21 racing starts. He's by On a Quest. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, Quest for Fame, which is quite a well-known racehorse stallion. And they're renowned for having a really good temperament, but they have a lot of white on them as well. And he's 9-year-old.
You've just won the Life After Racing event. Why did you enter in that event?
Well, I like to support the thoroughbreds because without racing, we wouldn't have all our quality thoroughbreds, and it's a special event for me.
No longer racing, he's in the show ring. What's the rest of his life like from here?
Well, as a 9-year-old, he's sort of getting to the stage where he's quite well educated now. We're continuing his education. We do a lot of dressage at home, but we're looking forward to competing at Grand Nationals in April. We're representing Victoria, and obviously there's a lot of other bigger events that we're looking forward to.
So he becomes really the main thing for you?
Yes, yes.
Does he ever get to a point where you sell him, or is he yours forever now?
Mum keeps threatening that she will sell him because he's just been such a consistent, honest horse, and he's very special to us. Maybe one day, I'm not sure. I'm very close to him, so he's one of my best friends.
They are 4 years and over.
Eliza's mum, Libby, says the event is great recognition of the work and change that racehorses undergo to become standouts in the show ring.
We've actually got on the track a horse that we've just brought out for the second time, and it's quite amazing. The last couple of times we've brought him out, just led, he thinks he's at the races still, so he shakes all over, and you can see he's digging a hole there frantically at the moment. But another couple of shows, and he'll think it's great, I'm not racing anymore, and their brain turns around and they go, well, there's life after racing, and we settle down, and they just learn to be princes as well, and have a great life.
Libby Green and her daughter Eliza from Wangaratta winning the off-the-track section at the recent Myrtleford show, thanks to Warwick Long for that report. Keeping with the horse theme here for a moment on Rural Reporter, let's hear now about another program in the Northern Territory that's helped keep troubled kids at school.
These kids we got here, there are four of them here, and we're doing some work just to help them along so they're not in trouble and stuff after school, and we also give them some horse experience and how to look after animals and caring for them, just to get them up and going and help them along with hopefully with their schoolwork and stuff.
It's hot and it's dusty here in the cattle yards at Jerry Kelly's place, but that doesn't seem to be worrying these young kids in front of me. They're having too much fun, riding horses, even shovelling up the horse poo to notice. Hello, I'm Carmen Brown at Tennant Creek in the Northern Territory, where the local primary school is trialling a new program to get troubled and at-risk kids back on track. For the past month, they've been bringing up to six children out here, every Monday afternoon, to work with Jerry. They learn how to ride and care for horses and other stock, skills that will hopefully help them get work as stockmen in the future. Just watched two young boys on the horses. How are these two going? Are they looking like future stockmen, do you think?
Yeah, well one of them is second time on the horse and he's going real good. Like he can trot and everything, and so that's his second time on the horse, and he's really like his old grandfather, but I can see of him. Yeah.
They did look like they were having fun out there, but it's not all fun. There is a lot of hard work as well. You've got them cleaning troughs and a few other things?
Yep, when they're finished with the horses, when they ride them, they hose them down, and then they do the horse poo before we give them a horse riding. We run around with a wheelbarrow and a horse rake and clean up the poo, and then they do the horse riding and hose them down and fill up the troughs, and then also do the cow yards too. So we've got two cows here. Now, don't put this water on the horse. Hold him away. Yeah? So don't put it on until he comes to
it. Does it take them a while to adjust to getting out in the heat and doing some hard work?
No, not if they like the stuff. The heat doesn't seem to worry them much, but if you can get them away from school, give them a break for that couple of hours, and then, that's the first thing they look for. They just love riding animals and want to be around with animals.
Peter Davenport is a teacher at Tennant Creek Primary School, and he's been bringing the kids out to Jerry's place for the past 4 weeks. He hopes the experience will change their attitudes and ultimately help them to stay out of trouble.
A couple of the kids need re-engaging into education to just give them some more positive outlooks. Jerry's a fantastic role model, and the skills he can teach them out here really give them a good self-esteem, and hopefully they can make some fairly good choices when it comes to their future. It's we're piloting this program this year, and we're hoping that it'll carry through to next year.
You've been here for a number of weeks with these kids now. They're out hosing the horses, riding, doing all sorts of farm work. What difference have you seen in them so far, just in these early few weeks?
Well, I think the motivation to be here is probably one of the key factors, in the sense that it's something that they're very keen to be out here. And if you said, boys, we're going out to shovel up a bit of horse poo, in the past they probably would have thought I was kidding, but they actually can't wait to get out here, do it all and get on the horses, and they see the whole thing as part of what they have to do, and they accept it.
Teaches them responsibility, I guess.
It has that side effect, yeah. We think that a program such as this, particularly something that they really like to do, they will see the benefits of all of it.
Jerry's been working with local kids since he started his business, Kelly's Ranch, about 4 years ago. During that time, he's seen some of his former students go on to work in the pastoral industry.
Yeah, we had a few that we took them out on the station. It was the station that they had some, we had them on the Barclay, and then also up near on the Western Australian border there. And then we had some at Prentice Highways.
So there's still a lot of work for stockmen?
Yeah, heaps of work for stockmen. They're screaming to see these young Aboriginal kids to go out on the station and work on the station as a stockman.
What's it like for you to watch these kids come through and change and succeed and go on to do these jobs?
Well, it's just like a dream to me, like the time that I spend with them and trained them all up. And when if you get someone will come back and doing real good. So it's you didn't waste your time working on him. You know, you put your work in it and then you got something back.
It's opened my eyes a lot. I'm probably a little bit apprehensive for a start, but once I met them and saw what they could do and their friendly nature, it's been a good experience.
Sharing contractor Ian McConnell needed some new roustabouts or shed hands to work in his teams, and he's found them all the way from Afghanistan. Hanif and Noor are two refugees who now call the southeast corner of South Australia home. Hello, I'm Wendy Collis in a shearing shed near Lucendale where crutching is underway. Hanif and Noor are being taught how to carefully cut the wool from around the sheep's backside to help prevent fly strike. It's physically demanding work, but they seem to be handling the sheep really well. So how did Hanif and Noor find themselves working here in the shearing shed? Here's Ian McConnell again.
I was having trouble trying to find some reliable workers and in the shearing sheds, and my wife rang around and got onto TAFE, and they in turn put job prospects onto like Karen, and they rang Karen and said that they had some guys from Afghanistan that had done a shearing course up at Kai Kai in South Australia. So we thought we'll take a chance, and it's turned out really good for us because they've been very reliable and good workers. Yeah, it's worked out well for both parties, hopefully. We've had regional trainers have been out with them from time to time, showing them how to throw fleeces and skirt wool and do that sort of stuff. And now we're sort of taking the next step and teaching them to crutch and shear. So, yeah, give them the opportunity and see how they go.
Initially, were you a bit apprehensive about hiring someone who doesn't speak English as their first language?
Yeah, I could see there'd be a bit of a problem, but they were overcome fairly quickly, and generally people have been pretty accepting of them. I think we've all sort of got a bit of a, I don't know, not phobia, but a little bit apprehensive because of the unknown, but they've settled in and worked in well with everyone, and it's been an interesting exercise, but a good one.
Okay, so now I'm speaking to Hanif and Noor. Hanif, how did you come to Australia?
I come by boat. Yeah, I come from Pakistan to Malaysia, Malaysia to Indonesia, and from Indonesia to by boat come to Christmas Island.
How long were you on Christmas Island?
Christmas Island, I live 4 months. After 4 months in transfer for cotton detention center. It is on Western Australia, you know. I live all Christmas Island in cotton. 19 months I live in detention center. They have English school and something over there. Didn't speak English. You know, I used English class over there in detention center.
You didn't know any English before you came to Australia?
I doesn't can speak English, yeah. Now I want to work, just work and money because help my family. Yeah, I have 3 children, yeah.
Why did you think of working as a sharer?
Yeah, that's very good. That's very good, a little bit hard work, but no worries, yeah. I'm not sharing, just sometimes last year a little bit crutching. And today, sometimes crutching, pressing, and good, yeah, no worries, it's very good, yeah. Hard work, it's good, yeah.
Noor, you've studied here, you've learned English here, that's quite amazing.
Before I don't talk English, now a little bit English, my English is not good, sorry about that.
Is sharing hard work?
Yes, the old place is not too hard, and the shearing and cutting very hard. Yeah, it is hard. I am happy, but I send money, my help, my family. It is want the money in the Pakistan.
Do you say g'day, mate?
G'day, mate. Yeah. Sometimes, yeah.
So it's been a long journey for Hanif and Noor, but they've been here this morning crutching at a shearing shed near Lucendale. I think I'll leave the last words with Ian McConnell. And how has the crutching gone this morning?
Very good. They're doing a great job, and they're sweating a little bit, but probably not as much as what I am. So
what's the next step for Hanif and Noor?
They can both crutch a sheep. They're getting better and better at doing that. Noor's been to another shearing school. He's improving all the time, and I'll give him a bit more of an opportunity, and hopefully we'll get him on a stand, and he'll just improve as time goes by.
Shearing contractor Ian McConnell, and let's hope Hanif and Noor can get their shearing skills up to speed and get work in sheds across South Australia. Thanks to Wendy Collis for that report. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. My name's Libby Price. Next, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. The No Harvest Party in far west New South Wales.
Coming up on Sunday Extra, the closure of Rio Tinto's alumina refinery in East Arnhem Land. What does the loss of 1,000 jobs mean for this isolated region? Also, it's 30 years since the floating of the Australian dollar, and we'll reflect on one of the most profound economic reforms in our history. And internet security and passwords. How vulnerable are we? That's all coming up on Sunday Extra with me, Damien Carrick, from 7 till 10 a.m. right here on RN.
A sorry saga this year on A Country Breakfast has been following the flagging fortunes of Australia's food processing industry. This week, processor SPC Ardmona met with its fruit growers for the first time since it sacked many of them and cut contracts in April. That meeting left 750,000 fruit trees earmarked for bulldozing and bankrupted some growers. This time it was different, with those remaining learning about the path forward for the company. Gary Godwill is a grower and deputy chair of Fruit Growers Victoria. He told Warwick Long the future of SPC and its growers still remains in the balance.
Well, we didn't expect big news that would give us any more light at the end of the tunnel, but things have looked up a little bit since that disastrous meeting. A lot of growers were given the sack at that meeting. Basically, the supermarkets sacked SPC and SPC sacked the growers. A lot of people trying to fathom out where they're going for the future. There's people like us who have been retained, and we're trying to decide whether we can grow for the price that is being offered to us. And we're also trying to decide whether there's a future long-term for us.
As a grower, how are you feeling about this season?
This season, we look like we're just going to tread water. And that's the best we can hope for. It's the future that we've got to look towards in terms of whether we're going to stay in the industry or leave it. So this year, okay, we'll get through it. We're certainly not going to get rich, but we'll get through.
It was at a meeting like this where fruit growers would once go and learn their allocated quota for each season. And it's a situation that many have always dreaded. This year, however, was different. Quotas were already decided when the company cut contracts in April and dumped some growers. Managing Director of SPC Ardmona, Peter Kelly, says this time it's more about keeping growers informed on the effort to keep the company operating.
There's always going to be detractors at in every group of 118 or so, but I was receiving a lot of positive feedback about what the whole team has achieved in those short 8 months since we had such a devastating meeting 8 months ago in April.
Are you going to pay them more for their fruit this season, or is it staying the same?
Yeah, prices generally are exactly the same as last season, so that's not a fantastic story for them. I'm sure they've got cost increases as we have. But this year has been about stopping the scale falling out from under us. So many of the good things that we've done have involved retailers paying considerably more to have Australian fruit versus imported fruit. But SPC doing all that just at its cost. We haven't improved our financials one iota. And what we've tried to do is to fill up that quotas that we had. It's a great satisfaction that we've stopped things burning at the core so much. A lot of the retailer support has been absolutely magnificent, and we've spoken about that before. But they have volumes and they have contracts that are still to run out, and some of those don't run out until the end of next year. And SPC already has still more than 1 million cartons of stuff that we packed last year that we haven't sold. So There's those issues we've got to clean up and clear up.
SPC Ardmona are still asking for government assistance to survive. The company has asked for $25 million from the federal government, $25 million from the state government, and has a promise from parent company Coca-Cola Amatil to invest significantly more than that to help the company innovate to survive. Managing Director Peter Kelly says without the money, the company is still at risk of closing.
We've had this conversation before, so there's no running away. We need that investment. And I'm just saying we have presented a case that I was extremely proud to present. It was a case full of innovation and optimism and can-do, and we explained why the industry is in the state it's in. You know, things like currency and unfair trade and dumping, they are matters for the government to solve, those matters. They run the economy. They run the rules of the economy. They run the WTO rules. And I think we have a strong case to show that maybe they should have done a bit more.
Without SPC, what would replace it? If SPCA was gone, what would you put in there and how much money would you invest in cranking up a new industry?
Grower Gary Godwell says it's time for government to step in.
Without that innovation being ramped up, without the capital being invested in the innovative products that SPC Ardmona wants to go along with, then I think we're all finished. We're all dead in the water.
Fruit Growers Victoria Deputy Chair Gary Godwell ending that report from Warwick Long. The end of harvest is usually a time for celebration in farming communities all over the world. But what do you do in a drought when it's been too dry to even think about sowing? On Saturday night, the farmers and townsfolk of Walgett in northwest New South Wales got together at the local sporting club for their no harvest party. Our reporter Sally Bryant was there.
All roads lead to Walgett tonight because misery loves company. This is a community in drought and they're getting together to blow off some dust at the Walgett Sporto. The party is the brainchild of Sarah Evans and Emily Collis.
We're celebrating the fact that no one has actually been able to plant crops this year due to the lack of rain, and it was a good opportunity for everyone to get together and get away from their dusty surrounds for the day and forget about the drought and enjoy a bit of cheer and, yeah, have a good time.
And you must be pretty happy. You've got a really good roll-up of people here tonight.
Yeah, Sally, definitely happy with the roll-up. We have a really good mix of people from really young children right up to our more mature aged residents in the Walgett area, and a really good cross-section. We always said that this event was not just about farmers. You know, dry times affect more than just farmers in rural communities like Walgett. They affect the whole town.
And that's something that you're seeing again and again across the northwest of the state as this continues dry, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, let's hope the rain comes soon because it's quite a scary outlook, I suppose. And hopefully we'll be telling a different story next year.
Because this stuff's really important, isn't it? I remember during the millennium drought that there were lots of farm family gatherings, that the whole idea of getting the community together was obviously really important.
Yeah, I think coming together, Sally, is a really important thing during hard times. I mean, we all love to get together during good times, but particularly during dry times and challenging times, I think it's important for us all to get together and to realise, you know, that we're not the only ones going through these difficult circumstances and that there are still good things in life, despite the fact that maybe things at home on the farm aren't going too well.
Farmer Bill Murray is the mayor of Walgett. He says farmers can prepare for drought, but it's a very difficult balancing act.
I think the last 4 years, which have been favourable, a lot of us have put away grain in the ground and as well as hay bales. But we don't know when the finishing line is, and you feed them all out, and then you've got to renew it. And what do you do then? Do you sell stock? What would be a big help if we could get, say, grain storage and hay sheds with accelerated depreciation, maybe the same as water? Yeah. That would be a big help.
So has that ever been on the table before? There have been a myriad of different policies over the last, say, 50, 60 years.
Oh, they have, and the mixture of them as well. And then they go, well, this time there is not really a drought policy, and that's the problem.
It's also being constantly said to people that they have to sell stock early, but there is a hole in that argument as well, isn't there?
Oh, there is. If you sell them early and then it does rain, well, you're left out with no stock and the price goes up.
So here we are tonight at the Sporto, celebrating a really ordinary season. It's about having a laugh when there's actually not too much to laugh at.
That was the whole aim of today's event, is really just that people can step away from whatever it is and just forget, and, you know, just to catch up with friends, because it's, you know, it's really important to, you know, keep those social interactions no matter how old you are.
And cool. if you can't get a bit of rain, you may as well have a party. I reckon.
And not only that, but, you know, who knows? You might go to a party and find yourself rained in because they're all dirt roads.
Yeah, exactly.
Emily Collis from drought-stricken Walgett in northwest New South Wales. It's long been claimed by those against wind farms that the turbines can make people living near them sick. But the latest studies found wind farms and people can coexist without damage to human health. The Environment Protection Authorities monitored noise levels at a wind farm near Clare in South Australia's mid-north. The authority released its results at a community meeting, with many residents angrily rejecting the findings. Lauren Waldhuter was there.
Some people who live near wind farms swear black and blue that they make them sick. Four families have left the area near South Australia's Waterloo wind farm, 30 kilometres southeast of Clare. But a recent survey by the Environment Protection Authority in South Australia says the noise wind farms make doesn't hurt people. For 10 weeks and at six different sites, the authority monitored high and low frequency sound and weather conditions. Science and Assessment Director Peter Dolan says this study is the first of its kind.
And also we were able to shut down the wind farm with the Cooperation of Energy Australia on six occasions. To our knowledge, no one's done that combination of things before.
So you had residents taking noise diaries as well, I believe.
Yes, so we did the physical measurements of noise with the Cooperation of Residents, and those six residents and also others who volunteered filled out weekly noise diaries to tell us when they heard the wind farm or when it concerned them.
So how did those complaints correlate with the measurements of noise or any other measurements that you were taking?
It varied quite a lot. There were a lot of periods of time when residents were concerned and believed or attributed the noise to be the wind farm, when we found actually that it wasn't the wind farm. So there was higher noise at those times, but it was from other things like vegetation and wind.
You were talking a bit as well about high frequency versus low frequency. What did you find in that case?
Generally, the higher the frequency, the less the impact of the wind farm. And we've generally known that from anecdotal material from residents previously. The noises they're concerned about don't tend to be high frequency tones. They tend to be at the lower end of the spectrum. And we confirmed that. The study found very little contribution with the wind farm at the higher frequencies. It was more about low frequency noise.
So what impacts are those noises having on residents?
We didn't find an impact. So the study found that the wind farm was meeting all of the guidelines that we apply to wind farms, including international guidelines that we identify to measure those things. That doesn't mean that residents aren't concerned, though. Residents are concerned at being affected by wind farms. This study tends to suggest that in this case it's not the noise.
Why do you think residents may be complaining about health effects or in some cases leaving their homes?
It's not up to me to speculate. Well, I mean, the EPA's role is to monitor noise. We've done that, and we weren't able to find anything in the noise spectrum which could account for the concerns of residents. But we do agree they're concerned, and more work will be needed done by health authorities or others about what that might be.
The EPA presented these findings to a group of nearly 30 residents at a meeting this week. Emotions ran high as many were frustrated with the findings and called on the EPA to change wind farm guidelines.
Energy Australia has approval from the Clare Council and with the blessing of the EPA to build six more turbines there, even though you know these people are affected. What do you say? What do you say when those development applications come up? Yes, those people are affected, but it conforms with the guidelines, therefore go ahead, put the turbines there in those extra locations in that unique situation. Or do you say no?
That's Mary Morris, who's part of the Mid-North Wind Farm Awareness Group. She says she often experiences ear pain, headaches and tingling when she's near the wind farm. I asked her why she thought the EPA's noise study found that wind turbines aren't harmful to people's health.
Well, that might be what their measurements detected, like their equipment, but obviously the people are being affected by something and they still recognise that fact. They just couldn't pick it up on their equipment and they'll be
forwarding a lot of the detail about what people are experiencing onto the health authorities. But of course we're disappointed that they're not going to change the noise guidelines, because there's obviously a problem here, but we'll just have to keep working through it with them.
A lot of the residents seemed, I guess, quite upset about what the EPA had found. Why do you think that was?
Well, I guess they feel pretty unloved in terms of, yes, the EPA says we acknowledge these problems you're having are real, but they're not going to do anything about it. What people want is the noise guidelines to be changed so that there is a quieter level required at night, but they're not looking at doing that at all. So basically we just go back to sleepless nights and things, and I don't know what it's going to take for the noise guidelines to change.
Mary Morris from the Mid-North Wind Farm Awareness Group, editing that report by Lauren Waldhuter. He spent his entire life working in the seafood industry but barely sets foot on a boat. Fishmonger Bobby Goodard from the south coast of New South Wales sells fish at farmers markets, but he really misses being a fisherman. Our reporter Lucy Barber caught up with him to find out why.
My name's Bobby Goddard. I live at Maria on the south coast of New South Wales. I've been there for 45 years. I've always been in the fishing trade. I started off with my father when I was a boy of about 9, and I just haven't stopped since. We've had markets going and road runs going, restaurants we deliver to and everywhere else.
So do you actually catch the fish yourself?
No, I don't, but we have other guys that work the boat, the trawler down there, and they catch the fish and then it's processed and filled in a filleting shed, and then it's packed and it comes up to Canberra. Yeah, my family's all been fishermen, me, my brother, my father, even my sisters. We were all licensed fishermen in them days.
But you don't fish for the fish you're selling?
No, we don't anymore, no. Too hard of work, and there's too many hours involved in it. And when you come on to doing all the selling of the seafood, you haven't got time to go and catch the fish.
So is that a big change that's happened since your dad and your dad's dad's generation in terms of the seafood industry?
Oh yeah, a great big change, a huge change. That's all I can say with that. It is a very big change.
What are your memories of going out and fishing yourself?
Oh, seasick was one of them, but other than that, you know, catching marlin and tuna and that over the shelf. And when we pulled the tuna over one day and it whacked my father in the side of the leg with his spike and put about 38 stitches in his leg, that was the one I can remember. He survived. Well, of course, it was a 7-hour journey from the tuna grounds back to the wharf.
So fishermen really are tough
they
nuts.
Are tough. And you've got to fight all seas, southerly gales and, you know, 15-foot waves. You've got to take these trawlers over. And it's not easy work. It's hard work. You earn every cent you get out of it.
What's kept you in the seafood industry?
I just like the game myself, and I like meeting the people, you know, and it's great talking to everybody that's involved, you know, and things like this.
Do you miss fishing?
Yeah, I do, but I just do a little bit of river fishing now with my little boat, and yeah, I like that.
So how does this all work now? You're at the farmers market today and you're selling your fish.
Yeah.
How does the production line work?
Well, we do Waden Market tomorrow morning as well, and that's the end of our 4 days. We come up here every Thursday, plus all the deliveries have got in between times, and it just takes up all your time.
So you're in the seafood industry, but you spend most of your time on the road.
Yeah, well, a lot of the time on the road, yeah. Well, we've got to get it from A to B, you know.
What's your pick of the fish here?
My pick of the fish would be John Dory. Got a flavour of its own. It's beautiful. It's a restaurant fish, actually. It's way above everything else.
So it's a white fish. How should one cook it?
It's got Jesus Christ thumb mark on it.
Explain that to me.
That's it there. See, they said when they first found this fish 100 years ago that Jesus Christ put his thumb on it, and that's how it got the dot on the flesh of the John Dory. Well, the John Dory's sister is called Silver Dory, and that's a mirror dory, which we have as well. But John Dory is a far better flavoured fish and a lot better texture as well.
So is a pan-fried scenario the best one?
You can pan-fry it, darling, or you can bake it in the oven, or you can grill it. There's several ways you can do John Dory, because it has no bones and it just falls apart in flakes. Bonza. A cracker.
Fishmonger Bobby Goddard from Maruya on the south coast of New South Wales, speaking to Lucy Barber at a farmer's market in Canberra. That's it for another week of A Country Breakfast. If you'd like to take a look at some of the photographs taken for today's stories, read some more of the news, even listen back to a podcast of the program, you can do all of that by heading to our website, abc.net.au/rural. Great to have your company this morning, and thanks to our technical producer, Mark Veer. On RN, I'm Libby Price. Talk to you soon.